the Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
Hey, this is Bill Carter. Welcome back to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. I'm glad to have you here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I stepped on your line, Bill. I'm Jeff Kellum, the co-host for the Spirit of Jazz podcast.
And today we've got a man who has a coffee cup that says, "This will be awesome." Say hello to Jeff Stockham.
Hi, everybody.
Formidable trumpet player, French horn player, and we've invited you here. Some are going to be asking Jeff why they didn't hear your melodious voice when we were doing the podcasts having to do with our tour on the road. I have simply answered them because you're so darn busy. You were doing multiple things. What, in fact, were you doing when we were in Williamsburg?
It worked out very serendipitously that the weekend that we were touring in Norfolk and Williamsburg and Richmond, I also was leading the Federal City Brass Band at the Military Through the Ages exposition at Jamestown Settlement at the museum.
You do a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm a collector. I've got a lot of antique horns, and you know, being a player, I play them, and I have a Civil War band that I've led for 20 years, the Excelsior Cornet Band, and I play in the Federal City Brass Band, which is also the 26th North Carolina Regimental Band, and I play in Newbury's Victorian Cornet Band. I played in the band that was in Spielberg's Lincoln movie called President Lincoln's Own Band, represented the Marine Band of 1865. And I've done a lot of stuff like that, period bugling and so on and so forth, playing the antique instruments. It's a lot of fun and very, very informative as to developing style for that period.
Well, and you are the youngest guy I know playing antique instruments.
Well, I know plenty of guys younger than me who are doing it.
So we want to spend this time together talking about how does a jazz musician make a living?
And as you said, you call this a living? Yeah.
How did the light go on that this is what you were to do with your life?
Well, if you want to go way back to the origin of it, I had two old maid cousins who were old when I was a kid. They were born around the turn of the 20th century on my mother's side of the family. They were both retired school teachers in Rochester, New York, and they noticed that I seemed to have some musical talent as a young child. I could sing back TV show themes and so on and so forth. I was good at imitation, and I just had some. They felt I had some musical talent. So they suggested to my parents that I get piano lessons. And so I started piano lessons in second grade and didn't love playing the piano, but liked it, but I liked music. That was about the time that Herb Alpert had his first hits. He inspired me to want to be a trumpet player. However, when I got into fourth grade, when they started us in band, my band director, Russ Messiri, knew that I had 2 years of prior musical training, so and a good ear. So he put me on French horn. And that kind of sealed my path for a long time. That was the direction I went in. I went through high school and all of the bands and jazz band on French horn, which was unusual. Started playing jazz in high school. The seminal moment for me for that, my freshman year, the band director brought in Louis Belson's big band that had all of the three-way beboppers in it, like Don Menza and Joe Romano, and it had the LA Cats. I think Frank Rosalino might have been in the band. I know that Johnny Madrid was playing lead trumpet, and he was unbelievable, just amazing. And they blew the doors off the place, and I tape recorded the whole thing on a little Radio Shack cassette recorder.
Oh yeah,
and
oh,
I still have the tapes. And I listened to that concert. First of all, it blew me away, and I thought to myself, "Wow, I want to do that."
How many French horns were there in that band?
Grand total of zero.
Yeah, you were on your way to a conversion then.
Yeah, basically, I did want to learn to play jazz, and I started copying the solos of players that I liked. I started getting a lot of, quite a bit of solo space in high school jazz band, which was unusual for a French horn player. And this being before I had taken up the trumpet, but I still had delusions of becoming a trumpet player in my mind. So I convinced my dad to buy me a trumpet, started playing a little bit of trumpet, and did the same through college. Well, college was Syracuse University. I had a great teacher, Bruce Hagreen. He was principal in the Syracuse Symphony. Marvelous, marvelous musician, great guy. I'm still in touch with him. We visit him regularly in Florida. At Syracuse, I was in the jazz ensemble, got a lot of solo space on French horn, started playing trumpet in a funk band, just us all students. And then I got into Eastman on French horn. And although training to be an orchestral player, I ended up playing a lot of jazz, playing in the Eastman Jazz Ensemble, and getting more experience playing trumpet on the side. Okay, well, got into Eastman, played French horn and a little bit of trumpet in the Eastman Jazz Ensemble. And then after I got out of school, it was just the school of hard knocks after that. I had various day jobs to pay the bills and played as much as I could at night and gained experience. Went from being a naive, green, inexperienced kid to actually starting to know what I was, know what I was doing. And the rest has just been a progression from there.
So you didn't go from Eastman into teaching a formal position somewhere. You started off freelance.
Pretty much, although I did when I was at Eastman, and for a couple of years afterwards, I taught French horn, took adjunct jobs at Hamilton College, Le Moyne College, Syracuse University, Colgate, and Cornell at various times. Mm-hmm. And again, more to pay the bills than anything else.
So tell us about some of the curious gigs that you've had over the years.
Backed up Tony Bennett in a big band a few times, Rosemary Clooney, Frank Sinatra Jr.
And tell us then about how the jazz world opened up for you. Who did you play with? What interesting musicians have you connected with?
Well, I started playing professionally with some groups in Rochester, like Roger Eckers and Nate Rawls' big band. There were some times when Nate hired pretty much the entire Eastman Jazz Ensemble, which was fun. It was a good band. Played with some Latin bands like the Orchestra Antonetti, Victor Antonetti's group, which is still going after some 40 odd years. And then after I moved to Syracuse, played with the Stan Colella Orchestra, which was the society orchestra in the Syracuse area, along with one or two other bands. That was when a city the size of Syracuse could support three society orchestras.
Wow.
Yeah. Just putting together my own jazz groups now and then, playing as a sideman in other jazz groups, started getting freelance calls. I put together a group about 25 or 30 years ago that I called the Jazz Police. Mm-hmm. And the genesis of that was that I walked into a club with a friend of mine, and there were some cats hacking away on the bandstand. And I think I leaned over to him and I said, these guys need a visit from the Jazz Police. And that, that was kind of the genesis of that.
You befriended Howard Johnson at one point, not the guy with the hotels, but the guy with the tuba and the baritone sax.
Yeah, that was an interesting chapter of my life. I loved Howard dearly as a friend, a colleague, and a mentor. You know, he really, really helped my career. And I met him, well, it's kind of a long story. Back in the early to mid 90s, I did a demo recording with a local guitarist, Jason Kessler, and he wrote a piece for me, which was a pretty complex jazz piece, a real up-tempo thing that he called French Bop because he wrote it for French horn. And then I played a flugelhorn tune also. And the drummer in the band, Chris Jones, was the son of the legendary jazz drummer Philly Joe Jones. Consequently, Jason sent the tape to Don Sickler in New York City. Is one of the most connected guys in the city. And Philly Joe Jones had given him his first break in the business. So he knew Chris fairly well. So Jason was hoping to connect and get a publishing deal through Don Sickler. And that ultimately didn't work out. But Don, who usually will just throw a tape in the trash, listened to this tape and said, oh, here's a guy who plays trumpet and French horn. And at the time, he was putting together the touring band for Thelonious Monk Jr.'s Monk on Monk CD, which was, recordings of material from Monk's father's Lincoln Center and Town Hall concerts with the big band. I got a call from Don Sickler, and he said, hi, my name is Don Sickler, and I'm putting together a band for Thelonious Monk Jr., and I'd like you to come down and audition for it. And I'm thinking, okay, who is this? Who's playing a joke on me? And it was funny because I had not too long before that heard of T.S. Monk's program to put horns into the hands of underprivileged kids in under-resourced school districts. And my girlfriend at the time had suggested I contact him. And I said, what would he want to do, have anything to do with me for? So, But all of a sudden, there I am in New York. I played some stuff for Don. He says, okay, we start rehearsing such and such a date. We go to Europe on blah, blah, blah. And we do an American tour, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, I find myself in a band with Howard Johnson and other amazing musicians like trombonist Eddie Burt and saxophonist Willie Williams and pianist Ronnie Matthews. Cats who have played with all the, who are the greats and played with all of the greats. Bobby Porcelli on alto, who was Tito Puente's alto player for many, many years. And all of these cats were, these were all amazing. These are people I ordinarily would idolize. And here I am sitting on a stage with them and they're digging what I'm doing. So, let's run with it. And so that's how I met Howard, and we did a lot of work together with Monk and with some other things that Howard put together. Did a few record dates as sidemen together, and we remained friends up until his untimely passing a few years ago.
Well, and so what you're inferring here is one of the key ways to make a living as a musician, specifically a jazz musician, is friendships, relationships, connections, networking, all the above.
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, you have to be a good player, but you have to be able to work well with other people. You have to play well with others, as they say. And you have to, you have to be reliable and people have to count on you both as a professional musician and as a human being, as a person, as a friend. Mm-hmm. They have to be able to know that you'll be there, you'll do the job, you'll be easy to get along with, and you'll pick up your check and go home and everything will be copacetic.
And I can testify to what it's like to travel with you and how much fun it is. So thank you for that.
You're very kind. Thanks, Bill. And back at you.
this concerns something I heard yesterday. I happened to be online and saw another adjunct professor, Andrew Williams, on doing a trombone thing live. And someone typed in a question to him about, do I need a master's in jazz performance in order to find work? And he said, well, if you really want to find work, you have to go where the jazz players are. And you have to do the networking. You have to connect with folks.
Yes. And yep, you do. You have to go where there is at least a fair number of good jazz players, where you have some hope of getting some work, and where you can network and where you can establish contacts and professional reputation. And you know, if there are a lot of big towns in this country where I would go and star, because there is no jazz scene. You know, I'm fortunate in upstate New York, in Syracuse, in central New York, that there is a pretty good cadre, you know, well, an excellent cadre of musicians, and also a pretty decent jazz scene. There are some clubs that are offering, you know, quite a bit of work, at least in small group settings, you know, duos, trios, quartets, things like that, and the occasional sextet, which is what I prefer to do. That's been part of my business plan all along, is to be a big fish in a small pond, because I could go to New York and I could live in a rat hole and pay $3,000 a month for it and not have a car and have to scuffle for, you know, grade B and grade C tier gigs, and because, you know, every great player in the world is in New York City. Okay, there are cats who are willing to do that. I'd rather be in a smaller market where I'm a little higher on the pecking order. It gets me more gigs. It gets me better gigs. And it's cheaper to live. And I can have a few toys and mm-hmm. have a decent house and a lovely wife and you know, just a life outside of music as well. And being in the smaller market allows me to do that. You know, I've found a balance of that.
Yeah. You know, Jeff Kellum, we are talking with a high achievement winner. He won something called a Sammy. And Jeff, tell us what that is.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, I've got two Sammys on a table in my living room. The Sammy is the Syracuse Area Music Award, and I won in 2006, I believe it was. My Civil War band won for best recording, other styles. And then last year, I was inducted into the Sammy's Hall of Fame for Syracuse area musicians who have apparently done some stuff.
Oh, you have.
So that was a great honor, you know, to receive that recognition from my colleagues and friends was really a wonderful thing.
I remember the first time I heard you play. I think it was a recording session that Al Hamm put together, and I thought, who is this guy?
Oh, was that the one for Jackie Tara Washington?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And we did Man with a Horn and some other stuff. Yeah, that was a fun session, and I really like how that CD came out.
We're talking with Jeff Stockham, the great trumpeter and French horn player, purveyor of Civil War instruments. Jeff, what's next for you at this part of your venerable career?
Oh, let's see. Right now, as the joke goes, I'm meeting the people on my way down that I met on the way up. But seriously, I'm just trying to stay as active as a freelancer as I can. I fully intend to keep working until the day that they have to pry the horn out of my cold, dead hands. You know, why would I want to retire? Yeah, you know, right. It's too much fun. It's too wonderful a thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
Someone was mentioning just a couple of days ago that this is the first time they'd been with an audience since COVID. And I thought, my gosh, I thought we were out of COVID a long time ago. But as you look back, as a performer, as a jazz performer, You must have been really lonely for a couple of years during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
How did you cope with not being able to play publicly?
Well, we went for close to a year after things shut down without doing any gigs whatsoever. I might have done two or three gigs, and they were socially distanced things, you know, towards the end of the first year. But it was difficult. I mean, I had no income, and mercifully, I was able to avail myself of the unemployment that was made available to self-employed people. And that's the only thing that kept me from going under. I got a small grant from the Blues Foundation that Joey Bonamassa sponsors, and that helped a bit. You know, it was mostly the pandemic unemployment assistance. And I can't tell you how grateful I was for that, because, again, that pretty much kept me from going under. Yeah. That made all the difference in the world until gigs started picking up again.
Yeah.
And the lesson there is that when you're a full-time musician doing mostly freelance work, when that work dries up, you don't have a fallback unless you want to go.
No, not really. Especially because the teaching dried up. And honestly, I quit all my teaching jobs shortly after the pandemic started. The colleges informed me that I would have to teach over Zoom. And A, that's less than ideal, much less than ideal. And B, it required more work for the same very short money. Yeah. So I decided it wasn't worth my time, and I would rather make use of my free time, you know, my enforced free time in other ways. So I quit all the teaching jobs and just focused on some other stuff. Went for weeks at a time without even picking up the horn, you know, sitting in front of the computer working on some music, arrangements and charts for things, and you know, just reassessing a little bit. Thankfully, things have kind of come back to something approaching near normal, at whatever that is these days. But the work has steadily ramped up to the point where I'm doing almost as much as I was pre-pandemic at this point.
Well, we are grateful that you are on the scene and on the planet, because we have witnessed the kind of joy and excitement, exhilaration even, that you bring to people when you play. So hear us when we tell you, on behalf of the whole Spirit of Jazz podcast listening community, that we are grateful for Jeff Stockham.
Oh, you're very kind, Bill. Thank you.
Amen.
Well, thank you for your time today, Jeff. So thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure, Bill, as always. Anytime that I can do anything with you, you know, I'm there.
Take good care, bud.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bop Music. To find out more about Presby Bop, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybop.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.